Welcome to the CBSSports.com basketball podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper, and I'm joined by Matt Moore, senior blogger. How do you become a senior blogger?
You know, I hated that name. They're like, well, we want to give you a title bump. And I was like, okay. And they're like, so we're making you senior blogger because they do senior writer at CBS. And so every time I have to explain that I'm senior blogger, I keep getting asked, like, is that possible? Because blogging's only like, 10 years. How can you be a senior blogger? And I don't know, man. I guess it just means I've been without pants a really long time.
What's fun about that is that you wrote a John Wall Bon Jovi post that made you feel really old. So just the whole senior aspect to it.
So old. So old.
Like, is it really inconceivable that John Wall wouldn't know who Bon Jovi is?
No, it's not, because I looked it up, and part of it in the post, Bon Jovi hasn't had a number one hit since Wall was born. But it's mostly just a matter of, it was when I started thinking about the fact, like, he had no concept of Bon Jovi, because even though I'm sure he's heard the songs before, like, he's had no concept of Bon Jovi, because like I said, no number one hit since he was born. But then I was like, man, he was four when Cobain died. Like, he was four.
Right.
And then it goes from there, and it gets progressively worse and worse to the point where I'm just like, man, there's like, Bon Jovi did the Super Bowl in 2003, and that he was old then, and Wall was 13. Like, so just this, it's the spiral of going down that loop. And it's really weird because, like, when I started, I'm having this experience because when I started blogging like 5 years ago, like semi-professionally, I was like the younger guy, and now it's 5 years later, and like none of my references have any sort of impact. Everyone's like, who is that? Like, I have no modern references to really be able to rely on. Like, I'm trying to go see more movies to be able to have new stuff to draw on.
So you're like, hey, kids, how about that hot tub time machine, huh?
Exactly.
The thing about the whole Bon Jovi thing is I was trying to think, like, when was the last time Bon Jovi was even semi-relevant? And all I could come up with was, I think it was Real World Philadelphia, where they had... like, his arena football team had the people from Real World, like, intern for him. And, like, that's the last time I remember seeing Bon Jovi on TV.
He was on an episode of The West Wing. I'm a big West Wing fan, so... That's like, the last time I remember him being that way.
I only watch the quality programming on CBS.
But here, you know what's crazy, though? Both Lost Highway in 2007 and The Circle in 2009, number one albums in the United States.
Really?
Really. According to the vaunted reference that is Wikipedia, that's never wrong. The U.S., both Lost Highway and The Circle, both of which I've never heard anything off of, were number one albums. Now, I don't like Bon Jovi as part of it. I'm not, like, upset because I don't like Bon Jovi, but... it's just weird to me that this guy that's like such a, he's a big part of, I guess, culture for most Americans, I would say. Like, Wall just has zero concept. A lot of people on Twitter tell me, like, I don't know who he is. Like, I got no idea. And I'm just like, okay, all right, I'm realizing, I guess, it's kind of like the 70s prog rock bands, the 70s and early 80s prog rock bands. I have no I can't keep them all straight. Don't tell Ken Berger this at all, ever. So.
Well, good thing he's not going to listen to this. we'll eventually talk about basketball, but I was trying to think, like, what's the last time I really thought about Bon Jovi on an album? And I think it was the Young Guns soundtrack, or maybe it was Young Guns 2 with the Blaze of Glory. And, like, that's a song that sticks out for me, and I don't know that that's a credit to them or even my own musical taste.
Was he on that collaboration for the Prince of Thieves soundtrack that had like four of those guys?
I just remember the Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart, and was it Phil Collins?
I think so.
Yeah, I think they had the All for One, yeah. All for Love song, which is a great karaoke song, by the way.
It is a really great karaoke song. It was surprising me too because I was looking at Bon Jovi's discography this morning, and I'm like, oh, Bed of Roses. I know that song. That's a pretty good one. And they recorded I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, which is a Warren Zevon song, which is just very, very strange. So, yeah.
Well, that concludes the weekly Bon Jovi segment of the podcast. We had two big things yesterday. One was a bad injury, and one was when Jeremy Evans killed Roni Turiaf. Which, like, I watched it last night, I don't know, about 20 times. Showed it to my lady friend. She was blown away by it. And then, like, I was like, all right, that was a great highlight. And I woke up this morning, and about 20 minutes ago, I was clicking through the Island Basketball blog, and I saw that I think Royce had put the video up, and I watched it again, and it was like watching it for the first time. Like, you forget already how high he jumps on the block and then just obliterates him on the dunk and then hustles back to stop a cherry-picking DeAndre Jordan. It was fantastic.
I love Evans, man. The guy, I mean...
He's a pogo stick.
He's just... It's insane. It's one where I really honestly want to be like, that's athleticism. Suck on it, baseball. Like, that's really kind of my reaction. It's like, you know, it's...
Take that, Prince Fielder.
Exactly. Or I'm just like, you know... I mean, the athleticism in this league is absurd. Evans was fun to watch last year, and he's, you know, he's one of those guys that's it's fun to watch. He's not a great player, but he's a lot of fun to watch. And you wonder, it kind of reminds me a little bit of a young JaVale before before the brain damage got to him.
I was trying to think about, like, you know, there was the Scalabrine run where he was kind of like an ironic garbage time superstar, right? Where, like, you wanted him to get in because he looked funny, because he looked like like Michael Rapaport had gained a few pounds and a few inches and got put on a basketball team. And then I was thinking, like, what? Like, there was Gerald Wallace when he was in Sacramento where the fans would just, like, chant his name. But, like, there's another, like, garbage time guy in the history of the game that's been as fun as Jeremy Evans. Like, he just gets in there into a game and it's just alley-oops constantly.
I'm sure there is one, but I can't think of one modern. He really is that guy that, I mean, he just, everything he does is really exciting. It may not be good all the time, but it's just really exciting. Like, part of it with me is the speed. Like, he covers so much ground, but a lot of guys do that. I mean, his ability to get down the floor to get clearance for that dunk, which was, you know, the announcer compared to Dr. J, and that was actually a pretty good comparison. I was looking, I was like, you know, actually does. That looks a little bit like Dr. J. And
yeah. Then,
you know, and you, like you said, to get all the way back down to the other end, I mean, that's crazy.
And he was the first guy back for the Jazz. Like, they were all celebrating.
Right? Yeah, it was an amazing play, and there have been a couple of those that actually haven't been talked about. You shared a Pekovic one.
Oh yeah, he had the two-handed block, which you don't see very often on I think it was Temple University's Pat Calathes. I think that's where he went to college.
Yeah.
And so he had the two-handed block, and then Kirilenko gets the ball, throws it up to Kevin Love, but it's a bad pass, and he kind of just, like, grabs it with one hand, flips it over his shoulder to Peck, who was coming down the lane, and he gets a nice little dunk on the fast break.
That one was good. Thaddeus Young had a monster one.
Oh, yeah.
That one was pretty vicious. That was one where I was like, who's that big for Philadelphia? I was like, holy crap, that's Thaddeus Young. You forget how big Young is. He did the full, you know, arm clearance, just hammered it. It was a really amazing dunk.
Yeah, you talk about the speed and the amount of floor that Jeremy Evans covers just by the way he moves. I hope this isn't too obscure of a reference for the audience, but it reminds me of the Simpsons episode where Nelson is laughing at the guy in the smart car or in the little tiny car, and he gets out and he's this gigantically tall, like, he's like 8 feet of legs, and he like basically walks after Nelson and picks him up and then humiliates him for all the people to see. And I, like, he kind of moves like the tall guy. Like, it's just these gigantic.
This is the largest car I can afford.
Right. Like, that's what it reminded me of.
I think my See, I end up using a lot of Simpsons references, but my favorite one is to use whenever something gets blocked. I always use I use it more in the context of a season. Whenever a season goes terribly and the fans are scrambling to hold on to it, and they're like, "No, it's going to be fine. It's going to be totally okay. Everything's going to be cool." I always use the one from the barbecue episode where Lisa turns vegetarian, where she sets the pig on fire, goes flying through the air, and Homer's running after it, saying, "It's just a little airborne. It's still good. It's still good." And that brings us to the Timberwolves.
Oh, yeah. So Kevin Love broke his hand at his condo working out, which is weird. I mean, that seems
which is odd.
It feels like one of those, what was it, 2000 or 2001, Jeff Kent for the San Francisco Giants supposedly broke his arm or his hand when he fell off his truck while trying to wash it, and we later found out that wasn't a true story. Like, I feel like this isn't a true story. Like, how do you break your hand working out at your home?
Yeah, I posed the question based off of the fact that he had the weird elbow thing where he fell asleep on it wrong with his arm, quote, dangling off the bed and injured it, and then, you know, missed a game, and then he wound up breaking two metacarpals in his hand. I'm like, I'm asking the question, like, is his apartment complex built on an ancient Native American burial ground? I mean, like, has he angered? Someone suggested to me that it's, if you want stupid things from Twitter, someone suggested to me that it's karma for him bad-mouthing Khan.
I feel like there's more tax to be paid on.
Because karma has a very messed up sense of priority.
Yeah, I feel like there's more tax to be paid on Khan's karma before it starts heading back the other way.
Right? So you wrote a thing yesterday kind of talking about where the Timberwolves go from here, and it was great.
Thank you.
You know, it was timely. It was nice for Kevin Love to break his hand when you came on so you could showcase your talents.
Oh, it was fantastic. I get to do something close to home. It was weird because it was like the first time I think I was the featured story on CBSSports.com for the NBA section. I was like second or third in the carousel for the main page. I'm like, well, this wasn't exactly the way I wanted to end up there.
Welcome, doom and misery.
And that was the thing, is you and I were talking yesterday, and you're like, oh, it'd be great if there's some breaking news so we can show you how we cover something when it happens.
And then the universe is like, hee-hee-hee, very well. So you're telling me this morning that you think that they're going to survive this, that you feel better about them making the playoffs with Kevin Love out for a month?
I oddly do, and just give me a couple of minutes to talk this out before you bring me back to reality. I honestly, like, people are like, oh, Timberwolves are making the playoffs this year. They're going to win 45, 50, 55 games. I'm like, wow, calm down. Like, I mean, this is a much improved team, but, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Rubio's return and how he's going to be. You don't know how things are going to mesh together. And then Love went down, and I wrote my piece, and I thought about it all night, and I woke up this morning, and I looked at the schedule, and I was like, I actually think this team is more likely to make the playoffs now if he's back around the start of December, because they have a very easy schedule to start the year. I mean, that doesn't mean anything, because it's not like they're the Thunder or the Lakers who are just going to roll through easy teams, but it gives Derek Williams a chance to, like, this is kind of, it's weird that he's starting his second season. It's like, all right, put up or shut up, buddy. Like, this is the time that you define your career. But he's going to have to play really well. He gets to play his more natural position. And if he's going to make a mark on this team, this is going to be the time to do it, to kind of keep them afloat. And all they have to do is really be around 500, like one or two, maybe three games under by the time Love gets back. And you know, they can make a run, because they'll get him back, have a little boost once he's back in shape, and then Rubio returns, and that'll be like a little confidence boost for them and a little more energy into the team. And, you know, assuming nobody else goes down with a serious injury other than like an ankle sprain here and there, I think it's a good way for them to grab momentum throughout the year. And now you put Kirilenko at the four, which he's probably better guarding the fours anyway. And he'll be operating out of the high post in Adelman's offense. I just feel like it's doable. Like, it's more like now the team has a chance to come together, to step up right away, and I think that only benefits them for the second half of the season. Now, please tear me down gently.
No, I mean, it's fine. I often say that when you lose your best player and MVP candidate, 30% of your offense and 20% of your rebounding, that's really the best thing for your team.
Oh, it totally is. No, it totally is. And this, what's weird is, like, I'm not a homer T-Wolves fan. Like, if anything, I've been accused of being too harsh on them and not a real fan of the team. And now Kevin Love goes down with an injury. I'm like, yeah, this team's got it.
They're going to be fine. You know, I'm looking at their schedule. I've tentatively targeted. If he gets back for the optimistic side of it, if it takes at least six, but it's an optimistic six, and it doesn't take the full eight. You know, his first home game is versus Cleveland on a Friday on the 7th, and that's a pretty good, you know, get back into the flow game. He's going to be facing, you know, Tristan Thompson, Tyler Zeller, those guys. You know, even Barajal. Like, I think that's a pretty good matchup for him to kind of get his legs, you know, back on the floor and get his feet wet again. But if you look at that, you know, there's 17 games that he would be missing in that scenario. 10 of them are against what I would consider to be playoff teams, depending on how you feel about Golden State.
Which I think if they're healthy, that's a really good team.
If they're healthy, yeah, so that's the playoff team. So you're looking at 10 probable playoff teams, which means 7 lottery squads. If they go 7-10, they're fine. If they're 3 games under when Love gets back, they are totally okay. And I think that needs to be kind of the goal. The concern I have is, like, you know, it's like, well, as long as nobody else goes down with an injury, oh, yeah, I mean, Andre Kirilenko, he's a spring chicken, and it's not like they've
had... By the way...
It's not like Brandon Roy is, like, a big bench contributor for them, and hold on.
By the way, Kirilenko, hamstring issues in the preseason, like, he seems to be fine, but that did happen. Luke Rednauer has had back spasms. Brandon Roy still has his knees. They're going to be totally injury-free.
One where I'm like, so what are they going to be running? Like, I was thinking about it yesterday. I was like, well, what are they going to be running here? And I was like, they're going to be running J.J. Barea, Nikolai Pekovic pick and rolls. That's what they're going to be running. Yeah, this is going to work out great. There's no way this goes badly at all. There's absolutely zero way that this can end badly. I mean, you know, I like Derek Williams. I wrote a big piece on another site talking about how basically, you know, it was saying essentially that their selection of him continues to not make sense. Like, what they could have done with that number 2 pick if they decided to trade it, instead of basically being like, well, we didn't get what we wanted, so we're going to go ahead and take him because he's a good player, so we're going to go ahead and take him. And it's like, yeah, but he's a good player. You don't have any – there's no room for him. There's no place for him. There's no role for him. Like, why are you trying to do this? Why would you do this? You know, and that's one of those things that makes me the most nuts, where I'm just like, you have no concept of the fit. And it's one thing – like, I've been wrong on that before, because I didn't think that Derrick Rose fit where the Bulls were at in when he was drafted. That was, you know, clearly insane, because I had no idea that Rose was going to be as good as he was, nor did I know that Beasley was going to wind up as bad as he is. But I feel like the Timberwolves, like, you can legitimately look at that and say, well, Derek Williams is not like a top guy. You know, he was older when he was coming out. He was kind of unexpected in terms of his development down there in Arizona. Like, you know, there were a bunch of signs to say, like, it was a weak draft class in general, so it was one where it was like, okay, you don't really need this, and yet they decided to go ahead and go with him. And now he's in this position where he's got to come in and really, like, really step up and do all these things. And I like his game and would love to see him on. I also like to see him somewhere that a little bit more that gets up and down the floor in a different way. The Wolves are fast, but just in kind of a different style. I'd love to see him in, like, a D'Antoni system.
Well, what's odd is that they're a fast paced team, but they're actually terrible in transition.
Yeah.
And I think, like, it's kind of how it was a couple of seasons ago. Like, they were fast last year, mainly because they turned the ball over so much, and that was the main thing to cut down. The thing that worries me about Derek Williams is he thinks he's a shooter because he shot really well 1 year in college, and maybe he's been a better shooter than most people he's played with throughout his life, but he's not a 3-point shooter in the NBA. Like, I feel like we're – I mean, he's not going to be the same type of player, but I feel like we're venturing into Dante Green territory with his jump shot. And you can just tell, like, it drives Adelman nuts. I mean, he took him out – he barely played him in the second half of the first preseason game because after a week of praising him for attacking the basket and training camp so hard and being aggressive like he's wanted him to, he takes 3 threes in the first 9 minutes in the first half of his action. It's like – You're doing all this work to better yourself, to be a wing player. You dropped, I don't know, like 18, 20 pounds. You're supposed to be this wing guy now, and you're just going to stand back and shoot threes. Like, you were supposed to become a wing so you can be quick enough to beat anybody off the dribble and defend threes. And And you know, that's why they drafted him, is they thought maybe this guy can become a wing. Maybe David Kahn was planning on getting rid of Kevin Love, because that's been attempted a couple of times since he took over. But, you know, I can defend the Derek Williams pick, because you want to be able to trust that your coaching staff can develop him into being a weapon. But so far, you know, there is no fit, and it's awkward, and maybe this Kevin Love injury is the way to get his confidence back.
Yeah, or it's going to put unbelievable pressure on him.
Right, yeah. That could completely go the other way and backfire and ruin his confidence if he doesn't play well.
To your point, by the way, stat check, the Wolves were the fifth lowest team in transition points last season, according to NBA.com, fast break points.
Yeah, they were, and if you look at the synergy stats, they're like, I think they're like 22nd or 24th in points per possession on transition. I mean, they were bad.
Which is weird, because you'd think that with Rubio, they would just like rack it up, and with Love trailing for the three, they would just like destroy it.
Yeah, and Rubio's influence on the team was, they were actually a better offensive team when he wasn't on the floor. And they were a much worse defensive team when he was off the floor. And, you know, I actually expected him to be a good defender, maybe not this good right away, because I think he did win like 2009 Defensive Player of the Year in Europe in his league, and he was always kind of a pest in his long wingspan and everything. But you really didn't expect him to be the defensive guy who kind of hurts the offense. But that's what the numbers showed in a very small sample last year.
It's so weird. That's just very, very strange. So if you're looking for leadership on this squad with Love out, you know, who do you turn to? Roy?
I think... Well, yeah, that was the funny thing, is I talked to Roy about leadership after their win against Maccabi Haifa. Is that how you say it? I'll have to get Noam Schiller on this. And he said, you know, I asked him, is it a weird dynamic because you're used to being the man in Portland and now you come into a new team with a new system that already has a superstar? And he kind of responded with, I'm not, you know, it's not weird. I'm not going to come in, like, I don't want to come into a new place and just say, like, hey, this is how things have to be, which I thought was a pretty good way of looking at it, because when he signed with the Wolves, you had a lot of Blazers fans saying, oh, just wait till things don't go his way, then he's going to pout, and maybe that will happen. And he even admitted, you know, chemistry's a lot easier before you hit that 2, 3, 4 losses in a row during the regular season. But if he's coming in with the mindset of being a role player and more leading as by example, I find that a very interesting leadership transition for him.
Yeah, I think that'll be kind of, yeah, I definitely think that's going to be an interesting kind of transition for him, especially, you know, he's still relatively young. That's the really weird part too. You know, we're doing this big thing on leadership today for CBSSports.com. It'll be up later. And I spoke to Iguodala about it. I spoke to David Lee about it. I know that Royce has got some material that he's going to be sending over as well. It should be a pretty strong piece. But I want to kind of touch on what you talked about there, which is, you know, we hear so much about locker rooms. Basically, the worst locker rooms are always, they're always losing locker rooms. I've heard actually a couple of days about actually a Western Conference finalist team in the last 4 years that was apparently had awful team chemistry because of the people involved in it. But in general, you know, it's one where when the team is losing, that's when guys start talking, and that's when it's like, well, he's just worried about himself, you know, and he just wants to, you know, he's wondering, he's just being selfish, and he's looking out for his own concerns and things like that. Do you think that some of that is based on, because I was wondering, is it based off of, like, which dynamic is it? Because there's two sides to it. It's either, well, look, you know, we're losing, I got to look out for my career. If our season is screwed because we're a bad team anyway, I got to make sure that I'm not hurting my career, especially if I'm in a contract year, or is part of it, or a bigger part of it rather, the function of, you know, we're losing, this isn't working, why don't we try this, which features me more, maybe that'll work. You know, and it's one where there's right. Obviously times when that's like, well, that's insane, but at least that's understandable and not necessarily a selfish concept. It's more of a, we need to do this.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because over the last year and a half, I've been here in Minneapolis firsthand to really witness Kevin Love trying to become a leader. And he is the leader of this team, but it's a weird dynamic because he is so young, he's the best player on the team, but they're not good. And trying to lead a bunch of guys, I mean, the end of the season last year when they were just getting smoked in April, you know, you had a lot of comments of not a lot of guys want to be here right now or not a lot of guys are taking it seriously. J.J. Barea spoke out about it. Kevin Love spoke out about it. And at Media Day this year, Kevin Love made a comment of you could tell, basically, like, you could tell the guys who had a date at the end of the season circled, and it wasn't the playoffs. It was, you know, they had their first vacation circled on their calendar. And those are all things, like, you love to hear your young star player say because he wants to win, and you want this serious attitude to come from your leader. But at the same time, he also spoke out right when free agency was starting, right when they were going through the whole mess with, like, trying to get Batum from the Blazers, saying, hey, it's playoffs or bust. You know, I don't know what's going to happen if we don't make the playoffs next year. I don't know if I'll, you know, basically saying, I don't know if I'll stay or if I'll ask for a trade or whatever. And it's like, well, that's poor leadership to me because you're saying that at a really bad time, a really inopportune time when your team is trying to get the upper hand in negotiations. To put them publicly on blast like that just seems like a poor decision to me. So there are times where he's grasping the leadership role and really doing good things with it. And there are times where he's slipping because he's still learning it because he's so young. And I wonder, you know, do you think that you can become a leader as a player, or do you think that you just either are or you aren't?
I don't think it's like shooting. You know, I don't think it's like shooting where maybe actually in another way it is like shooting, which is the worst statement maybe ever made. In another way is it's like Andy Bernard from The Office. And yet in another way, isn't it? Because it's one where, like, you know, Rondo couldn't shoot at all, but then he's made it to where he has shots that he can make consistently. Like, he has shots that he is capable of making, and players do that where, you know, they're not good shooters, but they have shots that they can make. I think that that's probably part of it. There are guys that are exceptional leaders, like, you know, Steve Nash comes into your locker room. He's a good dude. He's going to do the right thing. He's going to support you at the end. You know, Kobe Bryant is going to be who he is, and he's going to yell at you and bark. And he's, you know, there's, that's not going to change. That's in his DNA. But I think that you have to learn different skills. And like, I'm seeing that here in Denver because, you know, George Karl keeps talking about Ty Lawson, about taking it seriously. And Lawson's a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. I think Lawson's also kind of like, we win games. What's the problem?
Right.
What do you want me to do? Be better than Andrew? Be bigger than Andrew Bynum? You know, it's one where there's only so much that they can do. I think that you do have to develop it, though. I think changing entirely is difficult. Like, I don't think Michael Beasley's ever going to be a veteran leader.
Right.
But I think there are guys also. I think a lot. You see that with the bigs, though. Like Kurt Thomas. I don't know if he would have been considered like a leader. The older they get, the more that they take on that role. Unless they're in Detroit, apparently. But there's a lot of those guys that get older and they start to, you know, when they become veterans. Tyson Chandler is another great example. You know, Tyson, you know, went from real, and I try to explain this to people, and they're so hard on these young guys like DeAndre Jordan and JaVale McGee. I'm like, Tyson was a bust until he got to New Orleans, and he was 26. Like, he was a bust.
And even then, when he went to Dallas, people thought it was like a good move, but I don't remember anyone saying like, oh my God, this is what Dallas needed. I mean, he was kind of damaged goods.
Yeah. And then I think the leadership thing is also from covering the Mavericks in 2011 for the finals with what they were talking about. To me, the veteran stuff, people always wonder why do guys like that? And we talked about this yesterday. Why do teams like veterans? Well, the guys on the Mavericks team were talking. They said that they kept using the same phrase, which was they kept saying, we're all accountable to one another.
Yeah.
And that's something that's really big because young guys don't have a concept of that because they're just getting in, they're getting adjusted, they're getting used to the money. You know, they're used to having fun. They're kids. And that's a big thing. Is like when you're 19, you're not accountable to anybody. Like you're used to being taken care of. And if you're independent, you're enjoying being independent.
Right.
You're not used to being accountable to anybody. You have to get a job and be out of college and have a normal environment to understand, oh, like, if I don't get this work done, then other people have to work later. If I don't play well on the court, if I don't take care of myself, if I'm not prepared, other guys have to cover for me, and that's hurting our team. Like, they have to learn that concept, and I think that that's something that takes them, a while to do. With Love, I wonder if part of it is, you know, I mean, that's kind of the weird thing with him is it's like, you know, I think the criticism you said was fair in terms of that was bad timing for him to say that. But with him, with the contract stuff, with everything else, I just feel like, you know, even with as good as this team has made itself, he's still like, you know, this team is not being run well. This team hasn't been run well. I haven't been valued. I haven't been developed well. Like, this organization is, you know, I think he likes Adelman, but I think in general he's got concerns about, you know, and that's something I think is legitimate in terms of worrying about the future with him, you know, how much he's worried long term about what's going to be going on with that team and if they're going to be able to build a contender versus he knows, you know. It's also interesting because I've always imagined that he's going to end up playing with Russell Westbrook in LA. Like, yeah. That to me just makes a lot of sense based off of the UCLA and the fact that they're such good buddies and everything else. It's just one of those storylines where I'm like, yeah, based off of what I'm seeing in the NBA, like, I can see that happening. And that's one where I'm like, God, the leadership on that team, Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love. Woo.
Oh. That's either going to be the greatest leadership ever or just a train into hell. Like, that. Those are the only options.
And that's what's weird, I think, about the Thunder is, like, I don't think that Durant – I think Durant's a good leader, but I don't think he's necessarily outspoken. I've never been given that impression that he's not Kobe. He's not going to be – you know, he barks at Westbrook and whoever else when they get into a disagreement. He demands things, and he's supportive and nice to him, but I don't think he's necessarily, like, a real – you know, motivator or anything like that. But then again, you know, LeBron really wasn't until last season. It was one of those, like, you hate to make these really small things, but if you ask around and you ask, like, what kind of leader is he, the talk was always, well, he's pretty quiet. He talks a lot, but he's goofing around.
Right.
Like, in terms of leadership, he's mostly, like, he wants to set an example. That was how it was phrased, but I was like, that's not good. And then you would watch the finals games in 2011, and his pregame speeches were always terrible. Like the huddle speeches were always just... And I like, to me, like, those are indicative because those are big moments. As much as it's like those are cliche and then most of the veterans are going to tune it out, you want that extra edge in big moments and you want your guy to be able to say things that really get through. And I don't remember what he said in 2012, but I remember being like, oh, that's much better. Like, he was actually, like, saying some things and very emphatic and was yelling and was very much like, we are going to win this game. We are going to win this game.
And I wonder if that's, like, a thing where you need – essentially at least two leaders on a team. You need the guy that leads by example on the court, who is just so good. I mean, maybe that's where Durant's leadership is he's so good and he helps your team in such a impactful way that you think, like, oh, I gotta follow that guy. I mean, that guy is so damn talented that if I stick with him, you know, we're gonna go places. And then you need a guy like a Derek Fisher. Like, you need a... Because if you looked at, like, the Lakers pregame stuff, they're standing in the tunnel, it always seemed like Derek Fisher is leading that speech, you know? Like, it's not Kobe in there. It's not necessarily Shaq. Like, it was Derek Fisher bringing everybody together and saying, this is what we got to go do. Let's, you know, let's go out there and get them. And I think you need, like, maybe you need that veteran guy who's been around, who has seen success and failure and can tell you the difference between, you know, the two very clearly. And then you need the guy who will go out there, take those words and lead by example. And maybe that's what Kevin Love needs. Like, maybe he's a guy who is so good on the court. I mean, obviously he's not bringing the same success that Kevin Durant has in his career, but he is one of the top players in the league and he is so good. And it's a good where, you know, He's the best rebounder in the league because of how hard he works on the boards, and that's an effort thing that players can see how bruised he is, how scarred he is after a game, after four and five nights, whatever, and you can rally behind that, but that's something more that veterans appreciate. Whereas last year they had a lot of young guys on the team, and it's like, hell, we're just trying to get numbers and get to the summer relatively healthy so we can go on vacation.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, kind of like with the physical leader and then the mental leader, I think is very important because you know nobody's gonna be looking at Fisher and being like, that's the way we need to play,
no. Right?
But you know, having that guy that does speak for the team, and that's why, and we get, I think fans get frustrated with it speaking, the media gets frustrated with it from the, or at least younger media, I think. Older media doesn't do this as much because I think they get it because they're around it. Like the bloggers, we get frustrated when they bring in the veteran instead of a young guy with potential. We're always like, but he's not good. Like, he's not any good.
Right, yeah.
When you start talking to coaches and you start talking to front office guys, like, you realize, like, no, like, his ability to be in a locker room and to say, cut it out, is huge. To have weight to be able to come into a locker room and be like, this is not how we're going to prepare for this game. Because I think preparation is a huge part of it. Like, that gets overlooked a lot, but this is one area in which I think it translates from all sports, from baseball to football to basketball. Like, the thing that drives me most nuts and makes me really frustrated with both, you know, team locker rooms and the coach is when guys – when the team just isn't prepared for what is obviously a pretty big game.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like – it's like you need to be ready to come out and play this one. This one matters. You need to be ready to go. And that's rare in the regular season, but, you know, even – you know, the best teams, when we talk about consistency, the best teams are not the ones that, oh, things are going great and they're able to thrive. Like, the Spurs come out and they're consistent every single night when
right.
they've got their start, their guys playing. You know, they take the nights off to conserve their bodies, but Tim Duncan doesn't dog it during games. He comes out and he plays consistently, and if he struggles, it's because he's struggling because he's just not playing well, and that happens. But there's no differential in kind of the preparation aspect of it. So I definitely think that's kind of an impact. I mean, you know, it's weird because if you don't see it, it's just not possible to know how much that locker room environment helps. And that's one thing I think the Thunder have been really lucky with is they've just had – like if you know, I was in the Thunder locker room, I think, what was it, two seasons ago. We'll be three at the end of this year, and it was a preseason game. And – you can just tell how much those guys just love each other. They just love one another. And it's, you know, they were kids then, and that's a big question I have about the Thunder going forward is I have real concerns because I'm like, look, this is the time when they start they go from kids to men. Like, these
right.
guys are going to – and this is – and that means business, and that means personal life issues, and that means, you know, different priorities and changing bodies and the whole thing. Like, your world – shifts dramatically from going from 20 to 26. Like, you're just not the same person, and you have a different approach, and you want different things. And wanting different things is a big impact here, and I think that's got something to do with Harden. I feel for Harden because I feel like Harden's trying to figure out, you know, do I, you know, basically in his agent are like, well, you know, I can get the money and the stardom and be the guy, or I can be the role player on the championship team and have that experience of what's more important to me for my life.
And that's such
no guarantee they're going to title, so.
Yeah, and that's such a weird thing, too, because it's such a, like, a just polarizing aspect of fandom and trying to, you know, in quote-unquote experts trying to figure out teams is you get mad when the stars team up together because maybe they've realized, hey, it's really hard to do it on your own, and we're being judged on championships, so let's do, you know, let's get together. And at the same time, if Harden were to leave to go be the man on and maybe on his own team or be the number two guy on a team, like let's say he found a way to team up with Love, whether in Minnesota or somewhere else down the road, and that's your two-man combination, if he left for bigger fame and more money, there would be a good number of people like, what are you doing? You're an idiot, you know? Like, why are you – like, you're trying to be the man? That's so selfish of you, whereas – If the guys team up together, it's like, what are you guys doing? Like, you don't know how to be the man, and so you're just going to be selfish because you wanted the easy route. Like, there's no universal way to be accepted, and maybe that's because fans and, you know, bloggers and people that cover the league, like, we have a glimpse into the league, but we don't really know what goes on, you know?
Yeah.
And I wonder how you view that kind of... that kind of juxtaposition of the two attitudes.
To me, it comes back to the Jordan problem. That's to me is, and so much of the perception does. Jordan shaped the league in ways that are, yeah, it made it much more popular, and it got everybody really excited about the basketball, and it saved the NBA in a lot of ways. But man, like, there are a lot of bad things that came out of Jordan's time.
Sure.
As a result, because maybe that's just, you know, that's just part of it. There's good things and bad things, but. You know, for me, it's not only, you know, the on-court stuff with, oh, let's all take contested 18-foot jumpers off the dribble. That's what we should all do. You know, LeBron's penchant for that, and Carmelo's penchant for that, and, you know, even Kobe's to a certain degree. But I think, you know, part of it also is that's what we expect of stars now, is we expect, I'm going to score all the points, I'm going to do everything, I'm going to be a great defender, I'm not going to need anybody else, because, you know, the gap between Jordan and Pippen is perceived to be a gulf. It's, right. You know, in reality, it was, you know, an alleyway. And so we expect them to be able to do everything, and if not, it's like, well, you're not a star then, and you need to be just a role player. Like, you need to be Pippen. And it's like, well, there's different, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat here. There's different approaches that you can take to win basketball games other than that concept. And I think that, you know, with the superstar team up, it's one where with Miami, it wasn't, I think the talent was important for those guys in the decision. But think about also the fact that all of those guys know how to win games. I mean, that's a big thing that people don't really get is young guys honestly don't know how to win games, and it's not because of talent. And that really is something that I've been trying to hammer over the last 2 years, where I'm like, look, there's a reason the older teams win more. There's a reason. It's not just, you know, that's not random. You know, and yeah, there's talent on these teams, but there are exceptionally talented teams that don't win anything. The Kings, yes, are terrible defensively, but offensively they have a lot of talent and they don't win squat.
Yeah.
Like, all of these teams have a world of potential, and that's the thing, is we love those potential teams. And I'm not gonna back away from it. I'm not gonna stop that because I love watching them play. But I'm okay with them losing is the difference. Like, I know going in, I'm like, I'm not looking to see this team win a game. I'm looking for them to, you know, have some cool highlights, make some cool plays, you know, for one guy to get hot and to watch that. But I, you know, if it's against a team like the Celtics are going to destroy them, and it's not because the Celtics are more talented, because the Celtics haven't been more talented than their opponent in most cases in terms of the top teams in 2-3 years.
Right.
They made the finals.
They're just smarter in grinding out wins.
Yes.
Because they have that experience.
You know, and we talked about this kind of yesterday, where we were talking about like the Bryant thing, where you got to have do 100 things perfectly or you're screwed.
Right.
It's little stuff that I try and explain this to younger guys, where I'm like, look at how, and not even younger guys, the beat writers too, because they don't tend to pay attention a lot to some of the actual in-game stuff as much. There's some great beat writers out there, but, you know, there's also some bad columnists. But, you know, there's pay attention to things like, look at the speed with which he comes off of this cut and how precise his movement is. Like, he doesn't loop too much. He doesn't come in shallow. He gets right to the spot that he needs to be in, where the point guard knows to deliver the ball. He catches it with the right hand at the right moment, at the right place, and immediately goes into the right decision-making process. And, like, that precision is – that's part of the differential between the pros and college.
Right.
Is the precision with which everybody in the NBA does what they do.
And, you know? And what's funny is, like, you know, you talk about, you know, talent doesn't necessarily mean anything if you don't know how to use it or you don't have the team around you to use it. 2005 playoffs were without a 28-year-old Kevin Garnett and without a 26-year-old Kobe Bryant.
Right.
They were not in the 2005 playoffs, and they had their own team. And it's like, being the only guy on a team who can play and – or being the only great guy on a dysfunctional team can submarine you incredibly, because this league is simply too good now. Like, the strategy, the talent, the athleticism, it's way too good. And it has been for about 10 years. And it's, if you don't have a talented and decently intelligent team, you're screwed. It doesn't matter how good the individual is. Like, the team matters just far too much. Yeah, stars impact the NBA far more than they impact baseball or football or what used to be hockey, but that doesn't mean that stars can just do whatever they want and will it to victory. Like, this isn't a feel-good movie. Like, team talent and know-how matters.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's one of the reasons I like the NBA is because, as much as I love the underdog, because when it happens it's really exciting, the best team almost always wins in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And it's not the best teams in terms of talent. It's a team that's able to play the best, that's able to function and to execute. You know, and the Celtics have made a living out of basically creating terrible basketball over the last, like, 5 years. But they are smarter and they are more determined and they are tougher than everybody else. And that's how they win games consistently. And, you know, you really see that. And, you know, a good comparison on the other end of that, I think, would actually be the Nuggets last year, where, you know, the Nuggets should have had no shot against the Lakers. And they were able to push them to 7 and, you know, were there to be able to make a push. And that was largely because that team, even though they're younger, that team had a bunch of guys that, you know at least how to function on a team and how to win versus the Lakers. Their entire attitude, I think part of that was Bynum, and just a lot of their guys, like, they didn't have the same kind of attitude, and now they do, and now they're going to destroy everybody. Before we go, I want to touch on that. Man, I'm seeing projections out there. Basketball Prospectus is doing this. John Hollinger over at ESPN. A lot of these places, they're all coming out, and the Lakers are not projected to be these top teams. And I know that some of the metrics involved, like I tried to explain it when Hollinger predicted 59 for the Nuggets. I was trying to explain, like, well, you have to factor in how these things take shape from a statistical standpoint. They don't factor in, you know, some of the other things that can happen, and age really hurts you in these metrics because they expect a slide. It doesn't always happen. At the same time, like, I'm honestly wondering, is it possible that people are underrating the Lakers? I mean, we'll get to this in our Pacific podcast, but are we seriously in a situation where people could be underrating the Lakers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's just a difference between saying a team is going to finish second in the West doesn't mean they're the second best team. You know? Like, and it's kind of complicated in a way, but there are teams built for the regular season and there are teams built for the playoffs. And the Lakers are both, but they're more built for the playoffs than they are for the regular season. And with Howard, you don't know if his back's going to be okay right away. We don't know how Steve Nash is going to do away from the Phoenix Suns Warlocks in the training room. You know, they knew how to manage Steve Nash of, hey, his back isn't right, he's walking weird today, like, maybe only play him 20 minutes. Or maybe don't play him at all. And the Lakers training staff is probably very good, but they're not the Phoenix Suns Warlocks, and that's going to take some adjustment. So between those two things, you could have a couple of rough games during the regular season that, just by looking at the roster, you don't expect. But when the playoffs come, let's say they are the fourth seed, is that going to deter them from winning the championship? I don't think it is. Like, that, I always use the Atlanta Hawks of the last couple of years as an example. That team was built for regular season success and to get to the playoffs. Yeah. Once they were in the playoffs, there was nothing. They might win a first round series against the Bucks, but that team was not going to go far in the playoffs because they weren't built that way. And I kind of feel that way about the Nuggets. And I know a lot of people are really high on them and say, hey, this is a sleeper, this is a dark horse for the title. That looks like a regular season team to me. And when it comes to the playoff time, I just don't see it. I think they can get to the second round. Maybe they can get to the Western Conference if they get the right road ahead of them. But it's stuff like that where, yeah, the Lakers probably are going to be projected lower than their title chances are supposed to be. But I don't think that makes the projections for regular season success wrong. And I don't think the regular season projections are something to correlate to how good a team can be in the postseason.
And we'll talk more about this one next week when we talk about the Pacific Division. We'll do a lot on that.
Do you think we'll get to the Lakers in that podcast?
We might. You know, I might touch on it briefly. I wanted to wrap up with asking, kind of circle back to Love. An interesting point here. Two of their games in that stretch of opener, if he is out till December, and regardless, he'll probably miss both of these games, are against Golden State, who you have to think is, if it comes down to, like, Golden State and Minnesota are probably going to be jockeying for a playoff position, even if it's not. Like, I think they'll probably outdo. I think they'll probably be battling for like 6 or 7. But that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah,
there's come down to a tiebreaker. Losing Love early could have a huge impact if Golden State is more healthy than Minnesota.
God, that's depressing. And let's say, you know, in that stretch too. Let's say he's not back till mid December. That's two games against Dallas too. I mean, Dallas. Yeah. Dallas may not be a world beater this year, but I think they're, you know, assuming Dirk doesn't lose time because of his knee, you know, that's a playoff capable team for sure, and probably one fighting for the 7th or 8th seed. And I mean, that's a big stretch to miss. Yes, they have an easy schedule, but you're right; there are some key games in there.
It's when I try and keep this in mind when I'm thinking about things. I try and remind people of it as well. We talk about, like, oh, they were only the 6th seed last year, and it's like they were two games out of the 3rd seed. And when you factor in things like, oh yeah, like so and so got gastroenteritis, and, or
someone fell asleep and hurt their elbow.
Yeah, like somebody fell asleep and hurt their elbow. Somebody slipped on a banana peel and fell down. Like, these random things happen, and that cost you playoff playoff spots. Like,
yeah.
You know, the gap is really pretty narrow between a lot of those teams, especially in the Western Conference, and stuff like this is going to make an impact. So,
okay, so right now, do the Wolves make the playoffs? Yes or no?
Yes, the Wolves make the playoffs. I think that this is probably going to hurt them in terms of getting – I thought they could get as high as maybe 6 or 7. I think this is going to put them more in line for an 8. But I still think they made the playoffs. I also think it's going to be pretty comfortable. I think they make it pretty comfortably.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that's been drinking during this podcast. Thank you for joining me. We will we'll talk a little division preview for tomorrow. And check out the leadership thing on the Ion Basketball blog today. It should be pretty good. Thank you, Matt Moore.
Thank you, Zach Harper.
And this is the CBSSports.com basketball podcast signing off.